Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy conference call series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website at www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have Brian Grimm with us today to discuss the rise in religious hostilities around the world. Brian Grimm is president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation and previously was a senior research fellow for religion and world affairs at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. Dr. Grimm has also worked for 2 decades as an educator, researcher, and development coordinator in the former Soviet Union, China, Central Asia, the Middle East, and Europe. He's an author of The Price of Freedom Denied, as well as numerous research articles and academic books on global religion. Brian, thanks very much for joining us today.
Very good to be with you.
Yes. Before you left Pew, you worked on a study that looked at the level of religious hostilities and restrictions around the world. I would ask you to begin by explaining the findings of that study, including what statistics you found most surprising. Let me turn it over to you.
Thank you. Yeah, at the start, just to make clear that I did this study while I was working at the Pew Research Center, and then on February 1st left to head up the new foundation that you mentioned, the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation. So just to give a little background on what triggered this study and what goes into it, and then I'll share some of the findings and some that were, I think, particularly notable. Personally, I've been working around the world in China, the Soviet Union, when it was the Soviet Union, Middle East. And during all those years, I observed how religion functioned in society. I was doing aid and development work, educational work. And then in 2002, came back to the U.S. After 20 years abroad and started a careful study of religious restrictions on religion or restrictions on religion coming from governments and groups in society. And prior to that time, most academic study focused on religious freedom only looked at the government dimension. But the events of September 11th, 2001 made clear that even a small group of people can have a dramatic impact on the conditions in countries that affect religious freedom. So the study, taking account of both government restrictions on religion and social hostilities in the, involving religion, developed a number of indexes, first at Penn State and then at the Pew Research Center, where this study was carried out. So, but maybe a first question is, why would religious freedom be an important topic to study? For those that are concerned about religious freedom, that's not necessarily the first question on their minds. But for most people in the world, it doesn't cross their minds why religious freedom should be studied very carefully. Maybe a couple answers to that. First is that the majority of people in the world today are affiliated with a faith, more than 8 in 10 people. And even among the people that aren't affiliated, many of them have religious beliefs or engage in religious practices. So because it's so important to many people in the world, understanding their ability to freely choose a faith, change their faith, or even have no faith at all is an important topic of study. And also studies at the Pew Research Center have found that people affiliated with religion tend to be younger on average than people that are unaffiliated. So that gives some indication that in the years and decades ahead that we'll see even more people around the world being raised in households of faith. So religion will not likely become less of an issue, but more. So the study is based on a careful analysis of multiple sources. And then it counts up government restrictions on religion from constitutions, from human rights reports, and other sources for each year, and then adds them into an index. same with social hostilities from these sources that include human rights reports, but also reports like the International Crisis Group that cover, you know, conflict and where there's a religion-related element to it. So then these get added up into indexes. The overall findings are that about 43% of countries in the world today have high or very high restrictions on religion coming from either governments or societies. But because some of these countries are very populous, more than three-quarters of the world's people live in countries with high or very high restrictions. And we've been seeing this trend rise over the 6 years of the study. So just a few years ago, the study found that only 29% of countries had this level of restrictions, increasing now to 43%. So the situation seems to be increasing and with generally across the board throughout the world. One thing to keep in mind is that this study, though, is not a direct measure of religious freedom. It measures restrictions on religion, and in some countries, like France that bans the burqa and other conspicuous public displays of religious symbols in public areas, that they consider such restrictions important to keep the space open and secular and not religiously charged. So they have an argument for why they, a rationale for these restrictions. So the study itself doesn't take a stand on whether that's good or bad, but it presents that, you know, just measures that as a restriction. So in terms of government restrictions, we've seen that be rising over the years, but in the latest year of the study, it somewhat leveled off. So government restrictions on religion as measured by the study includes laws and policies of governments that either don't provide for religious freedom or restrict religious freedom. For instance, blasphemy laws, anti-blasphemy laws, are often promoted by governments as a way to reduce social hostilities. But the study has found that when these types of laws are in place, they're associated with higher restrictions and hostilities, not lower. And so they may have the unintended consequence of stoking additional violence, as we saw in the case of Pakistan, where two politicians who were suggesting that these laws be overturned or reconsidered were assassinated. Government restrictions also can include bans on particular faiths or restrictions on their practice. So, for instance, in Indonesia, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is not allowed to promote their faith or propagate their faith outside their mosque because they're considered to be a heretical branch of Islam because they believe a prophet that came after Muhammad that added additional information. But then after this ban on their activities was put in place, mobs attacked Ahmadiyyas in Indonesia, killing a number of them, burning some mosques down. So that would be on the social hostility side. So of the different types of government restrictions measured, when we add them up into indexes, we find about 64% of the world's people live in countries with very high or very high government restrictions. And these can include other things such as bans, restrictions on religious symbols, which occur in more than a quarter of countries, or imprisonment for faith-based activities such as promoting human rights as clergy do that, and that occurs in a third of countries worldwide, or restrictions on conversion from governments that occurs in nearly a quarter of countries worldwide. And those can occur at the national level or subnational level. For instance, in India, they have anti-conversion laws that are put in place to try to prevent somebody from paying someone else to convert or illicit or bribing converts. But again, another unintended consequence of that is that sometimes vigilantes will use that law as justification to attack religious converts who converted just by their own free choice. Now, the other new finding from this latest study is that for the first time, a larger share of the world's population now lives in countries with high or very high social hostilities involving religion. 74% of the world's people live in countries with high or very high religious hostilities, and that is now higher than government restrictions, and I mentioned it was 64% of the world's people. So examples of this include sectarian violence occurring in 18% of countries worldwide, religion-related terrorism, acts of violence occur in one out of every five countries in the year of the study, and terrorist groups are active in recruiting or other types of activities in 37% of countries worldwide. And sometimes these terrorist attacks and groups are operating quite cross-nationally, so there's also cross-border incidents involved. And then another type of social hostility is when religious groups enforce religious norms with the threat of violence or violence, which occurs in 4 out of every 10 countries. One example, a young man by the name of Alexander An was recently released from prison in Indonesia after serving nearly a 2-year sentence for merely claiming that he was an atheist. In Indonesia, it's against the law to be an atheist, and blasphemy is against the law. By saying that, he committed blasphemy. And when mobs attacked him, the social hostility, instead of them being penalized, he was penalized. So there was another connection between government restrictions and laws and social hostility. I'll give one last country example. In China, and I know some people were scheduled to be on the line interested in China. It's a country I've watched, and you know, 3 of my 4 kids were born in China back in the 1980s. So it's a country that I've observed very carefully. And compared to the 60s and 70s in China, when all religion was eradicated or you know, public displays of religion were severely penalized, curtailed, and many other social activities were as well, there was you couldn't imagine there was even a small speck of religious freedom. By comparison today, the Pew Research Center estimates about half of Chinese people now have some religion, the majority being folk religionists, but Buddhist has the 7th largest Christian population in the world. So there has been, you could say, a growth of religion, which is some indication of religious freedom. But in China, there's still very high restrictions on any religion the government considers to be a threat to itself or to what they would consider national security or harmony. So groups like house churches or groups that are unregistered, the government views them with suspicion that they're not joining the Three Self Patriotic Church. Falun Gong, a familiar example, because they consider them a threat to national security. The Catholic Church, because bishops in the churches loyal to Rome want to be loyal to Rome, then they're considered as a existential threat to the government. So they have very high restrictions on these types of faiths. And then so I've been watching this. It's sort of what I've described as the yin and yang of religious freedom in China. You can see some in some places, in other places it's very very restrictive, some freedom, some high restrictions. But for the first time in our study, we found that social hostilities involving religion had edged into the high category in China. And for years, they had been in the low and moderate category, and these hostilities include such things as the knife attack that happened recently at the Chinese train station, the self-immolations by Buddhist monks in Tibet, other types of social hostilities that are happening. There's a greater social hostility toward Muslims in general in China as a sort of spillover effect from the conflicts in Xinjiang, where actually 2 of my kids were born. So this is sobering, I think, for many people to see that religious freedom in China or this social hostilities in China are on the rise. And for many years, the Chinese government would explain that this is due to their low hostilities was because they had such good religion policy or restrictions on religion to keep hostilities down. But in at least in my analysis, not the Pew Research Center's analysis, but my own, that as you have the higher restrictions you have, that adds to problems that people feel related to religion. It adds greater grievances of religious groups towards the government. So that then is not an unexpected outcome of high government restrictions on religion, and I think we're seeing that in China today. So two last points, and then turn it back to you, is that the news is not all bad. As the one new type of measure the study's been looking at is initiatives to that governments and groups in society have to reduce restrictions and hostilities. And across the most recent 2 years of the study, between 2010 and 2012, 83% of countries had some initiative to try to address restrictions and hostilities. They haven't all been necessarily that effective because we still see restrictions going up. But it is a sign that people are aware that this is a growing problem. And the last point I would make, and what led me to leave the Pew Research Center and head up this new initiative, is that as I've gone around the world speaking at parliaments, the United Nations, European Union, even China, Vietnam, the Middle East, pretty much the people that show up to talk about religious freedom are people from government or religious groups, NGOs, civil society. But business people are not usually in the crowd, though it's in their interest. The data show that where you have religious freedom, you have better social and economic outcomes, better respect for women, better growth, more foreign investment, less corruption. So it is something that's in business's interest. And as I've been talking about this with people and sort of looking at the positive side of religious freedom rather than what I've been talking about on this call so far, all the problems in religious freedom, it opens up a whole new door. I shared this with the vice president of Brazil recently, Michel Temer, and I shared with him that of the 25 most populous countries, Brazil has the lowest government restrictions on religion of any over the on average across the 6 years. And he said, "I didn't know that. I'm the vice president. I didn't know that. You know, nobody talks about this." And he said, "Did any of you know that?" And no one in the conference room knew that. He said, "I'm going to write an article about this," which he did. And then he said, "I'm going to, you know, we need to do something about this." So we're in Brazil. We'll be having with the foundation and Brazil awards for businesses showing the best initiatives for respect of religious freedom in their company or in their societies or larger projects in the world. So I think that there's a whole new group of people that could have an interest in religious freedom, and those are businesses. So that's the new endeavor that I'm now focusing on, and it was motivated by the research that I've shared so far.
Wonderful. Brian, thanks very much for that comprehensive overview. Let's open it up to the group for questions and comments.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. Our first question comes from Robert Wilson Black with Sojourners.
Thanks for that analysis and report. Very helpful. What's the most common misconception that you find public figures, political or otherwise, have about religious freedom, either about the relationship in our country to others or their own religion and others, or some of those misconceptions that you can walk us through?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the most common misconceptions is that people tend to think that their situation is better than it is in comparison to other countries. So If I were in Indonesia and asked people about religious freedom, government officials, the general people in society would say, well, we have great religious freedom. We don't have any issues. Though by the measures in the study, Indonesia has very high government restrictions on religion and high social hostilities involving religion. Part of the misconception, or part of not understanding this, is that on a day-to-day basis, maybe these people might not encounter an act of religious violence, or they may not understand how the blasphemy law is actually creating problems for people. So they may interpret what they're doing as a defense of religious freedom. So one example, I was giving a lecture to a group of colonels and generals from around the world at the National Defense University last week. And from one country, I won't mention the country, but the officer was explaining why these blasphemy laws are so important to keep religious freedom and religious peace in the country. The actual facts show, though, that in that country, the more that the blasphemy law is propagated, the more it's misused. So I think that's a very common misunderstanding. Is to have a national view or an understanding of what's happening in the country is not being problematic when it actually may be. And if I can flip it around to the Brazil example, what I find is that some countries that have very good records, like Brazil or Senegal in Africa, a Muslim-majority country there, is that people aren't always aware that relative to other countries, that they are doing relatively better. And one reason in Brazil is that if I go and talk to Brazil and present the data, most people say, oh, well, but we have this problem and that problem. Seventh-day Adventists, have problems in the labor courts, and Afro-religionists, people are discriminating against them, and they list, 5 or 10 things, and they say, these are big problems. And I think that's sort of on the positive side of misconception, is that they don't realize how advanced they are. But part of the reason on the Brazil case is that because they consider very small problems big problems, that's one reason that they're, that at least my theory is, that they have the record they do.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Rodney Peterson with Boston Theological Institute.
Thank you, Brian, for your report. It's good to hear you. The question I want to ask may be different in different countries. In fact, I know the answer would be. But to what extent can you say religious hostility is really anti-Americanism?
Yeah, thanks, Arnie. Nice to hear from you. That's a good question. And certainly in some cases, there are cases where religious hostilities are anti-Americanism. So when Terry Jones burned the Quran, there were people who then used that down in Florida, the pastor of a very small church. There were people in Afghanistan, for instance, that used that as an excuse then to go and literally on a rampage and riot. So I think that happens at times, but that, at least in my view of the data, that's not usually, anti-Americanism isn't usually the trigger, because there were riots that happened because one Sikh sect killed the leader of another Sikh sect in Vienna, Austria, a few years ago, and that triggered deadly riots that went on for some time in Punjab in India. So these connections often are different, and it's not always anti-Americanism, America against America, but they may be reacting to things abroad. But by far, in a way, social hostilities involving religion tend to be local and tend to be local issues, and often it's between members of faith. And it doesn't tend to be over scripture or over religious things, but other things such as economic issues, so these things graft themselves on top. But I don't see that anti-Americanism is a big driver of social hostility.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Barbara McGraw with the Center of Engaged Religious Pluralism.
Hello. Thank you, Brian. I have a quick comment and then a question. First of all, I wasn't aware of your Religious Freedom and Business Foundation. I'm happy to hear about that. We here at St. Mary's College of California are going to be having a new class in the business program called Interfaith Leadership for Business and the Professions. And it comes out of an understanding that business is in a position to create superordinate identities around being religious pluralists in the workplace and through trade, et cetera. And so I'm very happy to hear about your foundation. So second, my question is kind of related to an earlier question, the one that has to do with perhaps this has something to do with anti-Americanism, but coming at it from a different direction, and that is related to restrictions on proselytization in countries like Sri Lanka, where and other places around the world where there's a tendency to see Christianity coming with, you know, neoliberal globalization ideologies, the two things coming together, and that part of what they're fighting with the anti-proselytization, particularly against Christianity, is also related to economic thinking as well. And I was wondering if you could comment on what you think about that, and if that kind of restriction is different, similar, etc., than, for example, blasphemy law issues.
Yeah, good. Well, I'm glad to hear of your program. I think, you know, I'd be glad to hear more offline if you want to share some more about the program in your business school. Those are the types of things that we're trying to promote through the foundation. I think certain types of restrictions are associated with other broader social issues. So religious freedom tends to involve, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of thought and conscience. So all of these things are connected, but then there are other connections to proselytism in that's a form of free communication and argument. You can think of proselytism in positive terms, not just negative terms, that it's people being able to make a reasoned argument to someone else that, you know, here's my beliefs. Why don't you consider them? And let me hear, you know, your ideas in return. So that kind of dialogue and openness is, you know, is also a kind of, don't take it the wrong way, but a kind of marketing. So openness to new ideas. So I think that proselytism in itself, the data that I've looked at, not at Pew, but in my other research, finds that it's highly correlated with other types of business outcomes that are positive. So rather than proselytism, it's often sort of a boogeyman or one that people object to, but I think it's something that can reflect a positive value in society as well.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ram Deslam with University of Hawaii.
Hi, yes, thank you. Thank you for your talk. Like Barbara, I have a comment and then a question. As someone who's worked for decades in rural India, my own experience of the anti-missionary sentiments up there, that those feelings often come in large part from a frustration by rural Hindus of the power and influence that so many missionaries have in the region. I mean, they come with money, medicine, educational promises, but they expect the souls in return. And even when that causes families to split apart, missionaries that I've spoken with, once they know that I'm American, they assume that I'm a Christian and that I'm supportive of what they're doing. And when we talk and I talk to them about their methods and that, they admit to me that they lie to people and that they divide families. They understand that, but they justify that saying that they're saving souls and that's much more important. And the and that what they've done to families I've seen has been ruinous in many situations. And so I'm wondering if, you know, as you're in your research, did you look into ways to gather information on the negative consequences that may come from evangelical efforts? And also, can you conceptualize a way in which such problems can be accepted or understood by these missionary groups and minimized?
Yeah, good question. So one thing that has come out of the, I mean, what you described of some missionaries, I think that might be true of some, but certainly not all. And I don't have any way to know, you know, what percentage of missionaries might, you know, be doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no, I can say that in my area it's a significant number.
Yeah, so you know, it may vary from area to area. So one response has been from the the World, I'm not going to get the name right, Evangelical Fellowship. So they have developed a code of conduct related to missionary work. In response to these types of things. So one thing that could be done is to share with Christian missionaries in this broader evangelical statement of ethics regarding proselytism. And so I think sort of at the global level and international level, evangelicals are quite aware of that it can be a problem, and they are taking some issues to address it. So I think even working within their own religious community to try and share these things is, you know, could be productive. Regarding the overall Protestant missionary effort, there's a very interesting article in the top political science journal by Bob Woodbury that traced social and economic benefit or dividend that came from Protestant proselytizing missionary work throughout the 19th, 20th century, so what he found was that where you had proselytizing Protestants, that was then associated, he argues, in a causal way with the development of education, printing presses, health, medicine, you know, sort of the things that you listed that they come bringing as so-called bribes, but to join the faith, but he found that it actually did improve education, health, and these things. And another researcher who's looking at things in northern India, or are you work in northern India?
No, I work in central India.
Central India. Yeah. Rebecca Shaw at Georgetown University is doing a study of the effect of conversion on entrepreneurial and economic activity of women and others as they convert from one religion to another in India. And she's found positive effects in terms of their self-empowerment and things. So I think maybe some of the observations you have may be accurate, but some of the research that's out there also gives a different side to the story.
Sure, but what they're doing is they're coming and they're bringing empowerment to people, and that's great, and they're bringing in help and stuff, but they don't have to tie it to evangelism. In other words, the improvement is not because they've converted. The improvement happens irrespective of their conversion, and I can guarantee you that in many of those situations, if they truly wanted to help people and they came in and did the help without saying, now you have to think and believe just like me, the same benefits would be there. And so all I'm saying is if you want to help somebody, then be honest in just helping. If you're trying to convert them, then be honest about that. But to suggest that by converting, by somehow changing the title of their belief system, now all of a sudden they're going to improve economically, I think is kind of a ruse.
Yeah, I don't think at least Becky Shaw's research doesn't show that it's not a matter of changing your label that makes a difference, but it's what she's found in her research, and it's been surveys of thousands of people, face-to-face interviews as well, that it's the new communities that they're now part of, supportive communities, that then sort of builds a social network and social capital, and also new ways of thinking that takes them out of, say, their old way of thinking into new ideas that are possible. What she's studying is the impact of the decision to join a new faith community and the new thinking and the new relationships that come and how that impacts people. So it's not just saying today I'm a Hindu and tomorrow I'm a Muslim, but it's actually all the different changes that are related to that. And the other thing, I think is important at least in the Protestant understanding of mission is that it includes, both sharing their faith and doing good. And for Protestants, if you take away the sharing their faith, then it's in a sense, pardon the expression, but it's like castrating what motivates them to do good. So to get Protestants to say, okay, I don't want to share about the most important thing in my life, my faith, with you, but I'm going to, build you a well, it saps their motivation. In Catholic experience, they have a different approach to missions, and they don't have as much of the proselytizing mission. So even within the nature of the faith itself, I understand your suggestion that, they should just come and give the cup of cold water in Christ's name, so to speak, but not mention Christ's name. For Protestants, that becomes very difficult. Well, it's same for Catholics. They would want to mention Christ's name, but Protestants also tend to have this conversion, drive to have others join their faith.
Sure, no, and totally. I totally agree with you. And just one last comment, and I'll stop there. But very often when they come, they don't admit that. They say, no, we're just here to help you. And they should just say, no, we're actually here to convert you. And in the process, we're going to try to help you. But just be honest.
Yeah, I as they say, honesty is the best policy.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Next question or comment?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dr. Shadari with Educators Society.
Yes, hello. Again, I'm kind of following up on Dr. Ramdas Lam's, but from a different point of view, kind of a flip side of what somebody has asked about, whether the problems in these countries are because they are anti-America. I'm really looking at the flip side of the coin and say that countries like India and China, which now have, billion-plus population in both countries, so when you put those two countries in some category, then, of course, your percentage goes very high. And that may be the reason that your percentage now is looking higher and higher. And the reason that there may be problems in India and China could be because now both of these countries are in a position where, they're not poor like they were 50 years ago, where missionaries went and helped and converted, and people thought that that's the price of help. India certainly is a democratic country and has states and laws, and understands that there is no freedom which is totally unregulated, including the freedom of elections. If you made elections totally free, like there is no law, there is no rule, just there is some kind of a thing, you go and put a vote, no matter what anybody says to you, if they give you $10 to or $100 to put a vote, that's fine. There's no laws, because that's what people want to do. They want to use their money. They make a good use of their money. There can be all kinds of rationalization that can be made. But every democratic free country knows that freedoms do have to be regulated. And these countries, certainly India knows, because I know more about India. So that may be one reason that your overall statistics, when you say that the problems of religious conflict are increasing, are really not increasing, but because you put these two countries in that category, and so your numbers will just go, they could continue to go higher. But in fact, situations may be getting better or fairer in the sense that people who do want to convert and are convinced that Christianity or Islam is a better religion or whatever, this certainly are there restrictions for them. So your research has to go a little finer detail, that are those people who are really convinced Are they being prohibited from conversion by anyone, vigilantes or anything? Or is it that these countries, now that they understand that they do not want to continue to have the imperial imposition that they had during the colonial times, and they don't want to continue that, and they know that even since you mentioned business as part of your foundation, that what businesses have done, for example, cigarettes are not allowed now in U.S. and in many establishments, and you know the consumption of cigarettes and smoke and tobacco has gone down here in U.S. But look, these companies are making huge money by selling in all these poor countries where people don't know the disadvantages. Similarly, Christianity has gone down here in the U.S. and all developed countries, all educated countries. And these countries like India and China are saying, like, well, so all this wealth collected by the churches is now being spent in these countries and other African countries to convert the poor people.
So why don't we stop there and let Brian comment? We have several more people to you, and I want to try to incorporate as many questions and comments as possible. So, Brian, if you want to respond, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Very, very important issues that you're raising. Maybe to broaden the discussion beyond India, that we talked about India a bit, is on the anti-conversion laws. In some places like Egypt, conversion by law is permitted into Islam, but not out of Islam. So in some places, there are laws that allow one-way conversion and not conversion in other places. And like in Indonesia, where I mentioned, you can convert freely between religions, but or more freely between religions, but to choose not to have a faith then is it can be severely penalized. So I think that there's, you know, across the world, there's a lot of different things people are reacting to. Sometimes it's the colonial past. And there are many historical factors that that continue to be part of the narrative that that people make decisions within, throughout the world, and even including in the U.S.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brian Cox with the International Center of Religion.
Hi, Brian. I work with the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy in Washington, and our center focuses on trying to bring faith into the realm of politics and international diplomacy. And I've worked over the past 25 years in many of the places that you're talking about, such as India, Pakistan, and throughout the Middle East. My question is this. As I was listening to you, and this was wonderful, you have a lot of great insight and everything. I was hearing much of the hostility in terms of in places where there's one religious tradition that that dominates and, shall we say, carries the social discourse toward, you know, minority communities. Did your studies include anything in terms of the level of hostility of secularists toward people of faith in general? And, you know, secularism is often presented as a neutral in the situation, but in many ways is itself a religious expression. So I'm just curious as to whether this was also something that was part of your study, and if so, what were the key insights from that?
Yeah, so that's a question that I've tried to measure without too much success, because what we've tried, so sort of the short answer is that it picks that up only to the extent that there's a secular attempt to restrict religion, but maybe in some of the ways you're conceptualizing it might not pick it up. But if I can give two examples, one is Turkey and France, and then I'll give another, come back to Brazil. Mm-hmm. So in both Turkey and France, they have laïcité programs. Turkey's sort of edging away
right
from it a bit. But, you know, they're very secular regimes trying to keep a secular public sphere, but really neither of them are very secular because in France, you can find certain regions of France where the state is fully supporting the church. And then they also provide religious education for imams in France. So France tends to get quite involved in religion. So the idea that a sort of secular state is neutral doesn't really work out in practice. China, being a secular state, certainly has suspicions and hostilities towards certain faiths that I've mentioned. So I think in those ways, it picks up secular restrictions on religion. But say sort of maybe you're thinking of sort of the secular European stance that religion is something of the past and we need to move beyond it, or get rid of nativity scenes in public spaces in Europe, and that happens in the U.S. I'm not sure the study picks up those types of restrictions as much, but they would pick them up if the state's involved or if physical violence is involved. But to Brazil, you mentioned about a dominant faith sort of being the driver. That often is the case. And one thing I noticed about Brazil in looking at two types of data is, one, it's had perhaps one of the largest religious shifts in modern history, where a third of the population in just a few decades has changed their faith to other faiths, from being 100% Catholic some decades ago to now being two-thirds Catholic, and most of the converts have been to Pentecostals and Charismatics and Seventh-day Adventists and Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons, and some a small percentage have become unaffiliated, but all of this change has happened without any social violence. And one thing that I theorize about it is, I mentioned one, is that people view small problems as a big problem in Brazil. But another is that the dominant faith, the Catholic Church, had just undergone Vatican II, and the Church itself took a stand that religious freedom is part of Church, they emphasize that individual religious freedom is paramount as opposed to the state guarding against heresy. So I think the dominant faith supported religious freedom, and that's part of why that change happened peacefully. And had it happened in many other countries, I'm not sure the outcome would have been the same.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Francis Flannery with the Center for the Interdisciplinary Study of Charism and Peace.
Interdisciplinary, but we say it incorrectly as well sometimes. Thank you so much. I was just wondering if you had found any correlation that you could speak about specifically between religious freedom and literacy, especially higher education, secular education.
Yeah, so the one study I had mentioned by Bob Woodbury, found that where there was the freedom to have proselytizing missionary activity, there were higher literacy rates. So that would be one indication. But then, in general, where there's religious freedom, just looking at rough measures around the world, we find that to be higher. And part of the explanation for that is that where there's religious freedom, religious groups have more ability to operate and do things they naturally do, which includes teaching people to read and write, sometimes so they can read the Bible, but other times because, it's just part of their social ministry. So I think there is so the data show there's some connection, and I think there's practical mechanisms that do that. But you mentioned something about secular education as well. I didn't quite catch what you were getting at there.
Did you find any correlations between really higher education, university education, but I'm really thinking in a secular venue, and reduced violence and or increased religious freedom?
Yeah, so, I mean, just looking at one thing I've looked at in my new position is different indicators of global competitiveness. And so if you look at those as measured by the World Economic Forum, and if you look at those, some of the basic building blocks of what makes a country and an economy competitive, those include primary education and health, and higher education and technical education. And all of those are stronger in countries where there's among countries with high respect for religious freedom, and they're weaker in countries where there's low respect for religious freedom.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from David Greenhall with Eden Theological Seminary.
Hello. Thank you very much. This maybe is a follow-up on the last question in some way, but you've made descriptive statements about correlations between religious hostilities and business or education. Are there actually prescriptive proposals you might make? That is, if one has a strong desire to reduce religious hostility, where's the best place to invest one's effort and energy? Is it at early childhood education, economic development, higher education? What sorts of prescriptive proposals do you, even if you don't have the data, if you have a hunch about?
Well, I think perhaps all of those things. I'm not sure I could pick one and say, here's the thing to concentrate on. I was just at a meeting this morning at CSIS on peace building, and you know, there's a lot of debate on ways to solve, you know, if you think of where there are bigger problems. And the sort of the conclusion of the meeting was everything needs to be done. You know, there isn't one thing that will be the magic bullet to solve, you know, hostilities and problems around the world, but it needs to be a multidimensional approach. So top-down types of programs and policies, as well as bottom-up. And sort of the bottom-up piece is one that perhaps many of those on the call could do more easily than, you know, influencing some national government to change their policy. But from the bottom up, people working in peacemaking and conflict resolution are recognizing that that's an important piece that's often overlooked. So some of the projects we're working on in my new foundation include finding religious minorities that are embattled or struggling or having problems, and seeing if their problems might be turned around to an advantage, and if there's some business investment that could be put there. So just sort of a creative way to look at where problems, see might there be an opportunity. So two examples in Tibet. I'm working with a researcher that's been trying to help Tibetan Buddhists develop tourist industry for mountain tourism to serve this influx of foreign and Chinese tourists that are coming in and wanting to see, you know, the mountains. And the Chinese government actually likes this approach because it's not splitist, as they would call it. It's getting this religious ethnic minority to do things that sort of take advantage of this new money coming into their regions in ways that show off their culture and religion. You know, that's sort of a grassroots, bottom-up approach. Another is in Pakistan. The Finnish Evangelical Lutheran Mission has been working there for years with their partners in churches in Pakistan, and they just see the situation deteriorating and more attacks and more discrimination and more problems and not much hope. But I'll be meeting with them to look at ways that a social problem in Pakistan is poor sanitation, poor waste management, not much recycling, might be a niche that some of the minorities, like Christians in Pakistan, could fill, because many of them are poor and working in, you know, in very manual labor, including waste, you know, removal, and get business investment there because there's a lot of money to be made in garbage, as many people have found out. So that, you know, that's sort of this bottom-up approach. I don't know if I've answered your question eloquently, but I think the answer is that, you know, all the things you mentioned and others sort of creatively, innovatively thinking of how to solve problems and help people are all ideas worth trying. Yeah, and all the billions of dollars spent in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, many people come away from all those efforts saying, here are the lessons we've learned and what we should have done. So I don't know that big money is always the solution, but, you know, a willing spirit probably, you know, goes as far as many millions of dollars.
Thanks.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Peter Weaver with United Methodist Church.
I was thank you for this very engaging conversation. I was struck by the statistic that you shared that globally religious affiliation is higher among the young and growing. And I'd like to find out if you've seen any correlation between the fact that young people are more religiously affiliated and the age groups that are most engaged in the hostilities. When I was in Nigeria, I talked to both Muslim and Christian leaders who were very concerned that it was the young who were most engaged in the violent hostilities in that very troubled country.
Yeah, good question. So just the clarification on the data. So the globally speaking, people affiliated with religions tend to be younger on average than people that have no faith. Exceptions include Buddhists and Jews tend to be the same or older than the unaffiliated. So all other faith groups tend to be younger. But there's, just to be clear, that doesn't mean that young people in the United States tend to be more religious or young people in
the United States. No, I know that. You were talking globally.
Okay. Yeah, so globally, populations that are younger tend to be, you know, a country population that's younger and growing tends to be more religious. That's where religion is. And I think that, you know, where there's youth, you know, there's often these problems. So it's not a, I don't know that it's a problem of religion, but, you know, the social dynamics involved with youth and where there's, you know, reasons for them to, you know, resort to violence, then, you know, they would. So such as poor economics, poor social conditions, but even in the U.S. we find, you know, more crime among the youth. So that tends to be a pattern that works globally.
I'm afraid that we must end. We've reached our witching hour of 5 p.m. Brian, thanks very much for your valuable insights today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you all that joined the call.
And I'm sorry, I know we had a long queue of people who wanted to ask questions. I apologize for not being able to get to you, but it seems like we need to return to this topic again, and we will try to do so. Our next conference call will be on Tuesday, April 8th. James Dobbins, Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan at the State Department, will talk about the outcome of Saturday's presidential elections as well as the drawdown in Afghanistan. We will be sending out the invitation after this call. We hope that you will join us. And as always, please email outreach@cfr.org with any suggestions or topics you would like to see for future conference calls. And we look forward to your continued participation. And Brian Grimm, we look forward to continuing to follow your work and to wish you all the best at your new foundation, Religious Freedom and Business Foundation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.